Please turn in your Bibles to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1. We're going to read verses 17 through 21 together. Daniel chapter 1, verses 17 through 21. As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. At the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them, and among all of them none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they stood before the king, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. We see here in the first verse of our passage, verse 17, the third appearance of the phrase that Daniel sprinkles all throughout the beginning of his book. It's that phrase, God gave. We saw it in verse 2, and we saw it again in verse 9, and we see it once again here in verse 17. This morning, before we get into our text, I'd like to take some time to think about that phrase and give some consideration to it. Daniel wrote a history book for God's people. There's no questioning that. Daniel wrote a book that looks back at the past and talks about how to live in the present because of that past. Daniel wrote the book probably around 530 BC. And at that point, if that was when he wrote it, some of the Israelites were already back in the land of Israel because they'd followed the decree of King Cyrus. King Cyrus came to the throne around 539, 538, and he decreed that the Israelites could return to the land and rebuild their city, rebuild their temple. And so some of those Jews had gone back to the land of Israel. So Daniel writes to a people both living still in Babylon as well as living in Israel. And there are many changes still happening to these lives. The chaos wasn't done. If you go back and read the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, you find that the chaos continued. They got back to the land, and the Jews are looking at their land, and they're seeing their temple destroyed. Their city is broken down. And then when they go to rebuild the wall, rebuild the temple, they're met with opposition from the Gentile neighbors. And even Haggai comes along and says that these Jews faced the struggle of their own flesh. Haggai says, you built your own houses, and yet you've not tended to the house of God. And so Daniel writes to these individuals who are living still in chaos and facing still great change. We could say it this way, that Daniel wrote a book that looks back in order to guide God's people moving forward. He's attempting to help God's people learn from history, lest they repeat it. Now, Daniel in this book provides a lens through which God's people must view their past so that they can live uprightly in their present day. This way of approaching life is not new to any of us. We do this when we go to the doctor. The doctor will ask, "Do you have any medical history to be aware of?" And they'll ask, do you have any heart issues in your family? Heart disease, heart attack. If you answer that you do, they'll prescribe certain things for your present day in response to that. So they might schedule more screenings or more health checks. They might prescribe a medication. They'll most definitely talk to you about your exercise and your diet. What are they doing? Well, they're prescribing present activity based on past patterns. And in essence, that's exactly what Daniel's doing here. He's helping God's people accurately understand the past so that they rightly live in the present. And this phrase that he keeps repeating, God gave, God gave, God gave, is central to a right understanding of the past, not just for God's people of Israel, but also for God's people today. And so, first of all, I want to look at four parts to this lens through which Daniel views the past and help us understand how are we to live in light of the past. And so first of all, Daniel looked at the past through the lens of God's existence. The phrase says, God gave. Now, every understanding of the past begins with a belief about this question, is there a God? And if you don't believe that, history simply becomes this giant pinball machine of cause and effect. Which means that in our present day, how we live today, if that's our view of the past, we live today by chance, by luck. We live today by panic. Concerned because what I do today is going to have ripple effect for tomorrow. But Daniel comes along and believes there is a God, and he views the past through that lens. He begins where every believer must begin. There is a God in heaven. And that's the first lens. And if you start with that, then it leads to the next lens. Secondly, Daniel looked at the past through the lens not only of God's existence, but also God's involvement. God gave. Now, some people stop short here. They're willing to believe there's a God in heaven. They're willing to believe there's a higher power. But they don't believe he involves himself in the affairs of men and women. One version of this is what we call today deism. The idea that God started the world and kind of got the ball rolling, and then he stepped back and he just lets it go on however it rolls. There are strains of evolution that approach creation and the nature this way. They look at God as the one who made the very first atom or the very first amoeba or molecule, whatever it might be, and then he turned it over to evolutionary processes and lets them go forward. If you look at the past through that lens, then our present and future become nothing more than a struggle for survival. This is the greatest good at the end of the day with this viewpoint. I'm simply here to be as strong as I can, to last as long as I can. And history becomes this cycle of people who get strong and they conquer the weak. And then those people who are strong, they become weak and they're conquered. And it goes around this circle. And all I'm living for is to be strong and survive. Daniel looks past all of that. He looks at the past with this conviction. There is a God, and he is involved in the affairs of men and women. God does intersect with man, and that leads us to the third lens. Because you can believe in a God who exists and a God who involves himself with men and women and still view the past wrongly. Daniel looked at the past, thirdly, through the lens of God's personal provision. We don't have a God who simply now and then dips his finger or toe into the pool of humanity and says, I'm in touch. We don't have a God who sits in heaven and scrolls through a heavenly Facebook feed and looks at all the pictures of all of the life going on and then puts it aside and says, okay, I know what's going on. We don't have a God who walks by all the problems of the world and just throws $1 billion at it to fix it, quote unquote. Daniel speaks, in this first chapter, he speaks of three specific ways God gave or tended carefully and caringly for his creation. In verse 2, God gave correction, chastening. His people needed it. In verse 9, God gave compassion. It's what Daniel and his friends needed before the chief of the eunuchs. And we'll see another aspect that God gives in verse 17 this morning. All of these things pointing to this fact that God involves himself in the affairs of mankind. He does so knowing what they need. And not just that, but he's able to give them what they need most. But one final lens remains. It's not specifically in that phrasing, God gave, and finish that off. But it's seen throughout the whole book. You could look back on your life and you see some pretty chaotic times, or maybe you're living in pretty chaotic times right now, and you're confident there's a God who exists. And there's a God who not only exists, but he involves himself in your life. And he does so caringly and carefully. But you're left with this question, to what end? Daniel looked at the past, lastly, through the lens of God's glory. And again, it's not specifically in the phrase here, but you read the book of Daniel and you get this sense that God is on a mission to make his name known, to be great, to be glorified. Why does God so carefully and caringly involve himself in our lives? Why does he appoint correction for us when he knows it will hurt? Why does he give favor in a variety of ways? Sometimes the favor of removing the trouble, and then sometimes the favor of strength and grace through the trouble. Well, you can't read the book of Daniel without realizing this, that God alone is great and he will be glorified. That's where God's going with all of this. That's why he works in our lives the way he does. That's why you have the past that you have. Because God is going somewhere more than just to give you a comfortable life or make you happy. God is going somewhere for his glory. This is exactly what Romans 8:28 speaks of when it says that God works all things together for good. It's not that all things are good. It's that he takes all things good, bad, and indifferent, and he works them all together for one good end. And what's that good end? That we would be conformed to the image of Christ. Why? For his glory. Because we would never get there on our own. And fundamentally, in our lives, if we begin to view the past through the lens of our own glory, our own greatness, we'll go astray. We'll start to live for our own greatness today. And upright living will fly away as the sparks fly upward. So I have a question for you this morning before we get back into our text. How do you view your past? I think most of us would probably agree with Daniel here. We agree God exists. We agree he involves himself in the affairs of mankind. We agree he does so caringly and carefully. We even agree it's for his glory. But folks, we often live, as one person put it, as practical atheists. We run around looking at our past, panicking because we think somehow we made a mistake, we took a wrong turn, we did something that's now causing and affecting everything now, we have this ripple effect, everything's kind of random back there. That's not how God intends us to live. If you view the past through this fourfold lens of faith, you will have light to walk uprightly today by faith. And frankly, that's where everyone is. Whether it's the atheist or the believer, everyone walks today by faith. So how do you view your past? Daniel looked at the past through these lenses and it informed his practice for his present day. Well, that brings us to our text this morning in verses 17 through 21. And for those who've been through times of chaos and change, I think this truth this morning is going to be one of the most encouraging we've looked at so far. I want to start with this question in verse 17. The question is this: what did God give these four youths? We have here in our passage these words: he gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. And at first glance, those four words, learning, skill, literature, and wisdom, probably blur together in our minds and seem to overlap. Depending on the translation you're looking at, it might seem even more redundant. The King James reads this way: knowledge, skill, learning, and wisdom. It just sounds like one word after another, all speaking of the same thing. Is God just being redundant through the pen of Daniel? Not if we understand the terms. And so this morning, what I'd like to do is take these terms and take them apart, understand them, and then piece it, bring it all back together for an answer to this question: what did God give these four youths? So the word translated first, learning, or knowledge in the King James, refers to what fills one's thoughts, what fills one's mind. Ecclesiastes 10:20 uses this word to refer to what one is thinking. The writer says, even in your thoughts, do not curse the king. He's talking about what goes on in your mind, even in that brain, the mind that God's given you. So maybe think of this word this way: it's information assimilated. This is what Solomon prayed for in 2 Chronicles chapter 1. He prayed for wisdom, But we're told there that he also prayed for wisdom and knowledge. That's our word here. These are the facts and figures that we put into our heads. I need knowledge or information. And God gave this to these young men. The second word here is the word skill. And in 1 Samuel 18, young David is described with this word. Only in that passage, it's translated this way 3 or 4 times. It's translated, he behaved himself wisely. Those 3 words, behaved himself wisely, is the idea of skill. So it's the idea here, the ability to do something with the knowledge received. It's the ability to process and piece together all of that knowledge for practical use. Knowledge emphasizes what one knows. Skill emphasizes what one does with what one knows. A good example of this is in Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 5. In that passage, we're told this, he who gathers in summer is a prudent or skillful, that's our word, a prudent son. Let's get the picture in our minds. You have a son, young man, who's out gathering harvest, crops. He who gathers in the summer, well, he knows something. He knows there's winter coming, and he knows it's harvest time now, and he knows make hay while the sun shines. But the verse isn't focused on what he knows. The verse is focused on what he does with what he knows. It's applauding his action based on that knowledge. The young man who goes out and gathers in summer is a prudent son, a skillful son, one who does something with what he knows. And the other 2 words in this list reflect what these youths knew and were skilled in, literature and wisdom. The first word, literature, is simply that. It's writings or books. We were introduced to these back in verse 4. These four young men are brought to Babylon and they're plopped into a degree program, and before them is placed books, literature, learning. And this would have included probably fields of science. This would have included culture of that day, religion most likely. This is the knowledge of the Chaldeans in book form. And then there's this word wisdom. It's a very common word for wisdom in our Old Testament. We don't have time to go through it this morning, but I'll give you kind of a summary of what this word entails as you look at it in the Old Testament. It's the idea of living God's way in God's world. Wherever that world might be, whether it's in Dublin, New Hampshire, or halfway around the other side of the world, another country, it's living God's way in the place where God has placed you. That's wisdom. So let's take all of that now and answer this question. What did God give these 4 youths? All right, let me just start kind of shaping this together for us. God gave these young men both knowledge, facts, and ability to live according to that knowledge. Or this, they learned and understood their culture and were able to live upright and godly lives in the midst of it. Here's a strong scriptural case for God's people to learn much about their world, their culture, not for selfish purposes, but for the ultimate purpose of being able to move through this present world in godly and upright fashion. When we were in Greenville, there was a man a little older than me. He served in the church along in the same ministry that I served in. It was a ministry reaching out to young people in the community. And every Friday night, we'd have 10, 15, maybe 20 teens, young men, that we would spend time with, playing some games, having a Bible study. And this gentleman that I'm referring to, he's now pastoring in another state, and I never interacted with him, crossed paths with him. He was before me, but I'm told that he practiced something very, very, very carefully. He would regularly, throughout the week, read and learn about pop culture. And he wasn't going out and attending concerts and, you know, watching movies and things like that to, you know, he wasn't doing all that. And he wasn't doing it, learning about these things for his own benefit. What he was doing was he was gathering knowledge because he knew that on Friday night he would sit down with 15 to 20 young men who were from an ethnically different background, an economically different background, and he would sit down with them and he would have to tell them the words of God. And he would pull together all of his understanding as best he could of their culture and their world, and he would deliver the message of God to them in a way they grasped. And he would know some things to avoid, some words that he might use and know the meaning of. He knew, if I say that, they're going to think this, and it's going to distract from the message of God. That's the idea here. Ultimately, this is the ability that God has given these young men in this foreign land, the ability to know facts and information about their culture and their world, but also to be able to apply that and live soberly, righteously, godly in their present evil age. And this passage, Daniel 1, 17 to 21, reminds us, assures us, that kind of ability comes from God alone. Folks, let's be cautious here. We see a young person who exercises some great wisdom, insight, and we say, oh, that's a wise young man there. Or we say, that young lady has her head screwed on right. And we're quick to ascribe it to human ability. But folks, don't mistake this. God is clear, and Daniel's clear. That kind of ability in God's people, that is God-given. The rest of the verse goes on to say that Daniel was also given, out of those four, Daniel was given specific ability to understand visions and dreams. And again, the emphasis is here that God gave him this ability. He's going to go on to repeat that in Daniel chapter 2. He says in Daniel 2, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what's in the darkness, and the light dwells with him." So what did God give these four youths? Well, let me compress all this down to one statement, one phrase. All of this taken together, God gave nothing less than this: divine competence for chaotic times. Divine competence for chaotic times. And when we're in the middle of chaotic times, isn't that what we feel most needful of? I need competence for this. I need wisdom. I need to know how to take the next step today. Well, God gives this to his people. But there's more to the passage here. We need to also look at the rest of this passage because there's a question that needs to be dealt with, and that's this. When God gives this kind of competence, what can we expect? Should we expect to be launched to the highest echelons of authority and power like Daniel was? I don't think any of us would say that. So let's look at our passage and see two expectations we can have when God gives divine competence. First of all, expect divine competence to prosper. Look at a couple of verses with me in chapter 1 in this passage. Verse 17, listen to these words: all literature and wisdom, and all visions and dreams. 19, among all of them, none was found like these four youths. And in verse 20, in every matter, 10 times better than all in his kingdom. Do you hear this? The total dominance of God's competence over all the wisdom of man. Folks, Daniel and his friends are not in the room with a bunch of high school flunkies. They are standing with other young men who are also the best of the best. They've also sat through the 3-year degree program. They've also looked at the same books. They've looked at the same lessons together. They've learned the same facts and figures. And yet when they stand before the king, here's what happens. Daniel and his four friends, 10 times better. The writer of Proverbs states it this way, "Do you see a man skilled in his work? He will stand before kings." The idea is, he's not going to be someone who just kind of fills a corner shadow. He's going to stand out. Someone who can walk wisely through this world in an upright and godly fashion, they're going to stand out. Divine competence, you can expect it to prosper, but we have to define the word prosper. How do we think of prosperity? We think of prosperity this way, as comfort, as ease. We think of prosperity as lack of trouble. We think of prosperity as a fat bank account. We think of prosperity as good health. We think of prosperity as a big home, a nice car. That's how we think of prosperity. Is that what God is pointing us towards? I think we understand that's not. See, prosperity in Scripture, God's definition of prosperity is this. Prosperity is God's name known and God's will done. And if we take that and look at the pages of Scripture through that lens, we see a number of good illustrations of divine competence prospering. I'll give you one example. In Luke chapter 2 and verse 40, we're told about Jesus that as a young boy, he grew and became strong, was filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. Here's Jesus, and he is receiving, being given this divine competence for life, skill. And immediately following that statement, we go into the story of Jesus being left in the temple. He stays in the temple, and Joseph and Mary panic and wonder where he's at, so they race back to Jerusalem, and they find him in the temple sitting there. And Luke says the teachers were listening to him. He's asking questions of them, and the teachers were amazed at his understanding and answers. As a 12-year-old boy, the divine competence Jesus possessed prospered before these religious leaders. Even before that, Isaiah says in Isaiah 52, verses 13 through 15, he says, "Behold, my servant," speaking of the Messiah, "my servant will act wisely." There's our word, competently. He's going to come and be skillful. And here's the result. "He shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted." Well, what's that a reference to? That's a reference to his death and his suffering and his crucifixion and his glorious resurrection. So what was the prosperity of divine competence in Jesus' life? It was God's name known, and it was God's will done. Jesus' life exhibited divine competence. He was able to move through this present evil world in a godly and upright manner, and it ultimately led to his death. But folks, that was not poverty. That was actually prosperity, because his death provides salvation for mankind. God's will done. And this has been the testimony of all of God's people, from Messiah to the martyrs. Divine competence prospers even when it brings men and women to their deaths. Expect divine competence to prosper by making God's name known and accomplishing his purposes, doing his will. But there's one other expectation we can have here. Daniel shows that this divine competence is not just a flash in the pan. It's not just here today, gone tomorrow. Look at verse 18 with me. At the end of the time, what's that phrase? Well, verse 5 told us that these young men had been enrolled in a 3-year program. So verse 18 picks up 3 years after they arrived in Babylon. These men are still young, most likely in their teen years still. But God has given them this divine competence. Now look at verse 21. Daniel was there before the king's throne until the first year of King Cyrus. Now, that phrase tells us that Daniel stood before the reigning king for possibly around 70 years. And we know from Daniel 10 that Daniel continued to serve, continued to live past Cyrus's first year. Daniel 10 says that in the third year of King Cyrus, he received a vision. And Daniel 6 says that Daniel prospered under the reign of Cyrus. So this verse in chapter 1 is not referring to Daniel's death, the end of his life. It's simply marking off an immense span of time. And it's saying this, that from the very point when his ministry began before the king to when it was done, or close to when it was done, during that whole time, divine competence persisted. That's the truth. You can expect divine competence to persist. Daniel served under 5 Babylonian kings and 2 Medo-Persian kings, Cyrus and Darius. I want you to turn over to Daniel 6, verse 1 with me, and see something that happened, a little snapshot we have from Daniel's life under Darius. This is just after Babylon has fallen, Medo-Persian Empire takes over. And verse 1 of Daniel 6 says that Darius restructured the government by setting over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom. And when he does that, Darius also set 3 officials over those 120 satraps. Daniel was one of those 3. So what's going on here? We're talking about change, chaos, new government structure, and Daniel's a part of that. Does the competence from God continue, persist through this? Well, read on, verse 3, Daniel became distinguished above all the other high officials and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the verse goes on to say that he was so competent that the king was actually considering putting him over the whole kingdom. Divine competence persists. Folks, God will launch very few of us, if any of us, to such positions of power. But we can confidently expect his divine competence to persist in whatever lofty calling he's given us, whether that is the calling of a student or a teacher, the calling of a homemaker, parents, businessman, technician, an engineer, whatever the calling in life, God will not fail to give his people knowledge and skill to move through this present evil age in an upright and godly fashion. The question is, will we avail ourselves of his competence? Before we close, I want to take one other lesson from Daniel's life that we'll see as we go throughout this book. How did Daniel avail himself of this wisdom? It's not stated in one statement, but I think there's testimony given that we can infer. And there's a passage in the New Testament we'll look at in just a moment that I think confirms this for us. But we know that Daniel was a man of prayer. Daniel was a man who lived on his knees. In Daniel 2, we're going to see a prayer to God that Daniel utters. In Daniel 9, there's another prayer that Daniel utters to God. In Daniel 6 is that well-known story of Daniel refusing to stop praying. Here's a man who prayed and prayed and prayed. And I believe he availed himself of that competence from God. And I think there's proof of that even for us today as New Testament believers. Turn over with me to James chapter 1. In James chapter 1, James opens his book by saying this to the believers, James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes in the dispersion. Hold on, what's the dispersion? Well, let me give you a picture of it. You have the Christians in Jerusalem. And here comes the Roman and Judean pressure, and it comes down like a hammer. Splat! And out go all the Christians in church. They're scattered. You have Christians running for their lives. You have persecution happening. You have families divided, homes split and ruined. And James writes to people in this kind of chaos, that's confusion, that's change happening. And he says this, "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, the testing of your faith." We're talking about times of chaos. You still have God's people in this world, and they still experience times of confusion and change and chaos. And yet, what does James say we so often lack and need? Look at verse 5. "If any of you lacks wisdom," there it is, competence, do what? Do like Daniel, ask of God. And it says that God gives generously, and he doesn't upbraid. He doesn't browbeat us. "Why are you here again? Didn't you get the message the first time? I told you about that on page 43. None of that. He gives generously. We still need divine competence to walk through this present evil age in an upright and godly fashion. And so we must ask for it. We must pray and beseech the Lord for it. Ask in faith. Ask knowing that God gives this competence generously, just like he did for those four young men in Babylon. Let's close in prayer.